In the history of baseball, there's been just one pitch that killed a batter. It was during the 1920 pennant race in a game between the New York Yankees and Cleveland Indians. The pitcher was Carl Mays, one of the most unpopular members of the Yankees. The batter was Ray Chapman, an outgoing, well-liked player. Sportswriter Mike Sowell dug into baseball history to flesh out the story. It's the subject of his new book, The Pitch That Killed. I asked Sowell to set the scene at the Polo Grounds on August 16, 1920.
On this day, Cleveland was in New York to open an important series. Carl Mays, the Yankees ace pitcher, was on the mound. Ray Chapman, the Cleveland shortstop, probably the most popular ball player in the game at that time and a very excellent baseball player, was the first batter up in the fifth inning. It was the first pitch of the inning. It was an overcast day, and as Mays was preparing to throw his pitch, he was an underhanded or submarine pitcher. And as he prepared to throw, he detected that Chapman's back foot was moving as if Chapman were getting ready to bunt. And Chapman was one of the best bunters in baseball. And at that moment, Mays made the split-second decision to throw the ball inside on Chapman, throw it high and tight. And so he threw it inside, and for some reason, Chapman froze on that pitch. He did not make an effort to move. And according to the catcher, the pitch actually was in the strike zone, and it when it hit Ray Chapman's head, it hit him in the left side of the temple, fractured his skull. But it hit with such force that it bounced all the way back to the pitcher's mound, and Mays actually fielded the ball thinking that it was a bunt and threw it to first base before he realized what had happened.
How did he realize that something was wrong?
Well, the first baseman fielded the ball, and this was Wally Pipp. He turned to throw the ball around the infield, and Mays saw him suddenly stop and look toward home plate with a shocked look on his face. And at that point, Mays knew that something was wrong. He looked toward home, and he saw Chapman sinking to his knees, and blood was rushing out of his left ear. And the catcher reached forward to grab Chapman to keep him from falling to the ground. And at that point, everyone rushed to the plate to assist him.
So Chapman collapsed. And you say that he wanted to, like, walk off the field himself, and that's really amazing, you know, that he'd be able to move at all, but he didn't quite make it himself.
He was down for several minutes, and they brought some ice out and tried to treat him, and he stood up and began to walk off the field on his own power when his knees began to buckle, and two of his teammates put his arms around their shoulders, and they carried him off the field. And this happened on a Monday afternoon. He was taken to the hospital that day, and the ball game continued. And the player who went in to replace Chapman to run for him scored what proved to be the winning run in that ball game, ironically.
Now, Carl Mays, the pitcher, complained about the ball that knocked out and killed Ray Chapman. What did he complain about the ball? What did he say was the problem with the ball?
Well, this was indicative of Carl Mays, one reason why he was such an unpopular figure at that time, that in the midst of this tragedy, when it was obvious that Chapman was hurt very seriously, although no one at that time could imagine that he would actually die from his injuries, but it was obvious he was seriously injured, and yet Carl Mays' first thought seemed to be on the baseball and pointing out to the umpires that the baseball had a rough spot on it, which Mays claimed caused it to sail inside and hit Chapman. So while everyone else was concerned about Ray Chapman, Carl Mays was worried about the baseball.
So the umpire actually took the ball out of play and mixed it up with the other balls, and there went the evidence.
Well, that's true, although whether the ball was scuffed or not should not have been too much of an issue because, as the catcher himself claimed, the pitch was in the strike zone. So whether the ball had a scuff mark on it should not have mattered if the ball actually was a strike. In recent years, there's been a man who claimed to have the baseball that hit Ray Chapman, and he has the fatal baseball. But this could not be because his story of what happened that day does not jive with what actually transpired on the field. He thought that one of the ballplayers picked it up and put it in his pocket. But actually, that baseball was thrown out of play, so whether it was scuffed or not, no one will ever know.
How did the Yankees deal with Carl Mays after the death of Ray Chapman?
The Yankees stood behind him. His baseball team was very supportive of him. In the meantime, just about everyone else in baseball was speaking out against Carl Mays, and there actually was a boycott movement to have him run out of baseball, where the other players in the league signed a petition to refuse to bat against Carl Mays. But the boycott effort failed, but the Yankees stood behind him all the way, and they insisted that it had been purely an accident. It was a regrettable accident, but one that just happened in the course of the game.
What was the rest of his career like? What was his pitching record when he retired?
Whatever one thinks about Carl Mays, whether they like him or dislike him, you have to admire the man and respect him for his courage and his determination. He actually won, I think he won 9 more games the year of the beaning and finished with 26 wins, and the next year he had 27 victories. Those were his two most productive seasons in baseball in terms of victories, and he pitched for 9 more years.
Did the fatal beaning of 1920 lead to any baseball reforms?
For a brief while, there was talk about use of batting helmets. No one at this time used batting helmets, and the players thought that this was not manly to go up there with any kind of a device on your head. But the following spring, the Cleveland Indians experimented with a batting helmet, which at that time was like the old football helmets of the day. It was a leather contraption that wrapped around the head. But they did not like it. It felt uncomfortable, so they abandoned the use of it. And it actually was 20 years before another team, the Brooklyn Dodgers, began experimenting with headgear. And it was 1958 before batting helmets or headgear were mandated by law in baseball.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering where you went to find out the details of this story.
Well, quite a bit of this came from researching the archives, reading the old newspapers and magazines of the time. I'd like to put in a plug there for the old sports writers. I think that back then, the sports writing was much better than it is today. Very
descriptive. I'm really surprised to hear you say that, because, you know, what I always read is that the sports writing in the early days, though maybe it's more of the 1950s that people are talking about here, was so kind of celebratory of all of the players, making all the players into heroes, that a lot of the really interesting baseball stories never really got told in the sports press.
Well, in a way, they did make the players out to be heroes, and they had some guidelines that they did not exceed. They would not report on certain activities, such as the ballplayers' off-the-field activities. But I think the big difference at that time was, without TV and with radio being in its infancy, the newspaper writers described the scene. They told you everything that was there. They did not rely on just going down and talking to the ballplayers. They painted a picture for you. And some of them were very good. Damon Runyon, Ring Lardner, just some great writers at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, some people think of the early days of baseball as being the good old days, the days when the game was cleaner. Now, you're writing about a period in which there was a pitch that killed, and it was the season after the season that the White Sox threw the series, although no one had known it at the time of this pitch. But looking back, do you think that baseball was any cleaner than it is today, or just the opposite?
I don't think it really was. There's some really, baseball was very much the same that it is today, with different problems. Today we have drug problems. Back then it was an alcohol problem. They called alcohol wet groceries, and there were a number of ball players whose careers were ruined by drinking. There were legal disputes between the owners. Players would occasionally threaten to go out on strike or hold out. Very much the same situation that you have in baseball today. But the difference is that it was the country was different then, and baseball reflected the mood of the country and the cross-section of people that lived in the country at that time.
Is there anything in baseball history remotely as dramatic and frightening as the earthquake that interrupted the series?
Well, there have been some tragedies similar to that. In 1902, the baseball park in Philadelphia collapsed during the game, and several hundred people were killed. The stands just fell down. This was a great tragedy at that time. Very much was written about it.
Given the earthquake, I'm sure you weren't sorry that you weren't in San Francisco for the series, but does it break your heart when there's a World Series going on and you can't be there to cover it?
Well, not really. I think the World Series has lost some of its appeal nowadays, now that they let television dictate the starting times. I'm more of a traditionalist. I think that the games should be played, at least the weekend games should be played in the daytime. And I think that they have, baseball and the TV networks have somewhat killed some of the interest in the World Series. Because of that, they've taken some of the mystique away from it to make it almost secondary to pro football.
Well, Mike Sowell, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. Enjoyed being on the show.